Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. The word value can mean different things to different people at different times. It can mean material value, the dollar cost or price of something, or it can mean something less tangible but in many ways more important, the importance of an idea or an experience or a principle to live by. Now, if you're talking to an economist, most of the time you'd expect to be talking about material value, how much something is worth in dollars or how much a policy or regulation affects financial gain or loss. Well, today we're going to talk about all this with an economist who has a deep awareness of how an economic practice, a policy, a principle, or a behavior affects well-being and happiness, whether that of a person, a family, a group, an entire community, a nation, or an ecosystem. Economist Mark Anielski is the President and Chief Well-Being Officer of Anielski Management, Inc., a consultancy firm based in Edmonton that he started up 31 years ago. Mark's going to help us understand that value and the wealth that it represents is not limited to material assets. Mark, it's wonderful to have you join us today here on Planetary Conversations.
Thanks, Warren, for having me.
You started your career not as an economist, but as a forester. There was an economics degree, but then you went into two more degrees in forestry. Why early on in your sort of professional work did you go into, what led you into forestry?
Well, as with your journey into medicine, actually my first aspiration was pre-med. I was in pre-med school at University of Alberta. And I thought stupidly that I would make it through dental school or maybe optometry, but first year was a disaster as an 18-year-old. It was fine. And then I thought, you know, what would I do if there's no way I'm going to make it? And I was kind of dejected by it. And then I thought, hang on, my girlfriend's dad was a partner with Coopers & Lybrand. And I thought, I could be an accountant. So I got an articling position in 1981 with Coopers & Lybrand, or actually 1980, and had a year of that. And I was like, I think I'm done. I don't like auditing.
Oh, dear. The gray life of the economist all by itself just didn't cut it.
But it was great because I got a foundation in business. I had to do enough courses in the business school to, you know, qualify to write that uniform final exam, which I never did because I quickly discovered in 1981 that there was a big recession, right? I mean, you remember those days.
Yes, indeed.
Mortgage rates were 19% or 18%. So they wanted me to stay on, apparently. And I said, nope, I'm going to check out this really boutique area called Forest Economics, because very close to where I grew up was Canadian Forest Service. So I went over there and I talked to some weird forest economists, and I thought, got my econ degree now, and I minored in German and music, by the way. Weird. And I kept going, and I thought, you know, I could do another degree. So I got into forestry school, forest science at the U of A here, and quickly did my almost killed myself taking way too many courses than I should have. But, you know, 2 years later, I graduated with, and I'm a professional forester. 1984, I'm like, hey, I need a job. I boldly interviewed the only forest economist in the Alberta government, and he was going off to Australia, and I got the job.
You got his job.
I got his job. And then my role with the Alberta Forest Service was to value nature, to value the intangible things like wildlife and parks. And so that was a very good introduction to large-scale planning, land use planning. And then finally, ultimately, I decided, you know, if I really want a job in the federal system, I probably need a master's or a PhD. So I got a master's in forest economics. So I'm this weird, rare thing called forest economics. And you say, well, how did that go into you studying happiness and well-being?
Yes. Well, I don't think it was a direct line.
It connects. Like, not only do I love to hug trees, like the part of the reason I left accounting and a lot of my friends in the Coopers, now PwC, were envious because I left. I said, because I love the outdoors. I love climbing mountains. And
it's a twist and turn journey of the highest magnitude. Did your family play a role in sort of leading you into some of this stuff, or were you being rogue at the family and the economic level as well?
No, my dad's a German immigrant. He came in 1953. He didn't have any degrees. My mother didn't have any post-secondary. But we were all educated and, you know, relatively wealthy south part of Edmonton. And, you know, I went to Catholic high school. So a lot of my classmates were, they did go to medicine. They did go to dentistry. They did go to engineering. So for me, it was like, of course I'm going to go to the University of Alberta. I never went to any other university. I thought, well, I got 3 degrees from the same university. You know, and I got into this later in my life to study, like, well, what are you called to do? What's your vocation? And I still, sometimes I say, I still don't know what I'm supposed to be doing.
I'm so pleased to hear you say that. That's such a civilized thing to say. The people who say, oh, I knew from the beginning I was going to be, you know, a successful businessman and I'm going to have $1 million. And soon I got $1 million, then I wanted 10, and then I wanted 100, and now I want a trillion.
Then some people now call me, like, so I got into this happiness stuff. And so some people call me a spiritual economist. My mentor called me God's auditor. I was like, whoa, in my book, you know.
Indeed.
Introduction. And I thought, that's pretty cheeky. But
That was Herman Daly.
Yeah. He said, called me God's. I said, I want a business card that's God's auditor, no contact information. That's right. And as you and I discussed, I also had the spiritual aspiration, I thought.
Let's talk about that, because that when we talked about it, it was quite clear this was a real turning point in your life. And it was a turning point that you actually facilitated. 1992, you managed to get 3 months paid leave, which is a very clever thing to do. And you head out off to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So why don't you just outline, I mean, it's a fascinating story. Why don't you outline how that process came about?
Well, so part of, as all of us, we all have this kind of, I think, spiritual yearning, or you know, we want to discover our essence, right?
And for sure.
So, and growing up Catholic, it was like, we have this notion of vocation, that inner voice, that calling. And I thought, I was 31 or years old. I thought, I'm not married yet. Like, what do you want from me, God? I'm an economist, but that's kind of, it's okay. And I'd gone through a very spiritual kind of awakening, I would say. I call it a kind of a reconversion when I was 26. And that's when I discovered the actual beauty of Catholic theology, teaching, and Christian theology. And I started to read the saints. Thomas Merton was my, so sure. You imagine me 24 reading Thomas Merton in the forests here by where I live in Edmonton.
He was 27 when he went to the monastery.
Right.
You were virgin.
Read all of his books, fully steeped in, and I thought, contemplative prayer, what a cool thing. This guy's a rock star, right? And he really shaped my thinking, and I was drawn. I thought, you know, maybe, and I know Thomas left, you know, the monastic life. And I'm like, all right, maybe I'm called to that. I don't know. Something's calling me to discover, do my vision quest.
Sure.
So I thought, well, why not go to the Holy Land? Why not go to Egypt? You know, sail down the Nile, you know, go to these ancient places, see if I feel something.
Wait for the heavens to open, the road to Damascus.
Right. The road to Damascus, just, well, not quite like St. Paul, like I wasn't blinded or anything, but it was an awakening, a great joy. It was a totally joyful experience. And then I was clear to me, it's like, no, I'm supposed to return to the temple of economics and understand the money changers, understand the money system. So then I I became very passionate about studying banking and money, how it connects to well-being. You know, why is it that we're so obsessed with money, which is a distraction from our divine calling, right? That's how I started to view it. And I got zealous about this, or animated, shall we say.
Yes. And you used the word zealous, zealous about full cost accounting, no superficial assessments. Let's do the whole meal deal.
Of course, my deputy minister thought I was insane. I said, why don't we value the water policy that we're developing here from a full cost perspective, as if we can value the value of taxes, you know. So that's pretty awesome, aspirational for accountability, because I've got this accounting thing in me, this weird accountability aspiration, shall we say, or expectation. So
isn't it something about taking responsibility? Isn't it really about accepting that when you get gifts, you also have responsibility to husband them?
And that notion of stewardship, and even the father of accounting, Luca Pacioli, and his best buddy, Leonardo da Vinci. No one ever hears Luke. I never heard the word Luca Pacioli. I saw da Vinci's stuff, but who's this Pacioli guy, this Franciscan mathematician and monk who designed the double entry bookkeeping system with Leonardo? You know, it's like, ooh. And it was an accounting friend, and my Jewish accounting friend in Ottawa, worked for the Auditor General. He introduced me to this. I didn't learn any of that in accounting classes at U of A. And I started studying him. And he said, you know, Luca was very interesting because, he's a Catholic monastic, the brilliant mathematician, advisor of the Pope. And he says, all wealth comes from God. Like, ooh. Because now I'm like, I'm really fascinated with the etymological roots of words.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So language is a big deal. And you say that in many places. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's my favorite book, the etymological dictionary, right? So I look up the word wealth. Oh my goodness, it means the conditions of well-being. Yes. It's like the cousin of health. It's like wella is well-being and th is the conditions of something. Mm-hmm. So health and wealth are cousins. And Lucas says all wealth comes from God. Okay, why do we keep account? Because we're stewards of the wealth we're being gifted, right?
And a forester, you would have had to do things like maximize the annual allowable cut.
That's right, I'm maximizing. It's like, you know, economists like upward sloping, demand curves. Why is that's weird. Maybe guys like that, but I can make some funny jokes about economics. But, that said, like, why do we have to keep growing if we have enough stuff and if we have generally well-off people, but we have distribution issues, of course. So what's wrong with this? Why is this push to grow like cancer? Like, why? What's driving it? And then I went to Herman Daly and he said, this is the most important question of your life to inquire, is what is actually driving this continuous and for growth.
You know, you describe being steeped in Christian and Catholicism teachings, but a while back I looked up all traditions in their attitude towards wealth, and they all say the same thing. It's great to have enough money for your own needs, your family, your close friends, and then everything beyond that is there to share with other people. And it's funny the tradition is unbreakable. There's no other way of looking at it in any of the world's traditions. Even indigenous teachings are often to share. If you have enough for yourself, share the rest. Yeah.
Because they still operate on natural law. And I said, what happened to natural law? What happened to the teachings of Aquinas, right?
Yes.
How did natural law get subterfuged by common law or civil law? These are the fundamental questions I start asking, like, what is natural law? What is God's law? What is creator law? What are the seven grandfather teachings? Why are they still relevant? You know, on and on. Now, and go back to forestry. How does the forest behave? Why doesn't the economy mimic the forest ecosystem?
Indeed.
Why doesn't the money system mimic the forest ecosystem?
When you were in this vision quest, it was quite a tumultuous time, sort of up and down, back and forth, going to places, some of the places in the Holy Land, which are... as we call it, we're centers of spiritual energy, if you like. And you described to me, and I think many people have had this experience, that you could feel sort of an energy that was present, and it was not in words. It wasn't, you know, a manual or a tourist brochure or anything like that. It was just a feeling that you could have. That kind of experience must have shaped your sense of what is valuable in life. It's not just the tangible stuff or the physical stuff or the material stuff.
Yeah, it's a supernatural. Mm-hmm. You know, we're hardwired. We're supernatural beings. We're spiritual beings in the flesh, right? So, but that's why I love the mystic. Like, I don't actually like the structures of the church. I like the mystical. I like the St. Francis of stories. You know,
sure.
Not even Aquinas. That's what drew me to reading, I guess, Merton, or trying to understand if we're steeped in this, in the reality of the supernatural. And I experienced the energy of Jerusalem because I was there. I was sitting there for 2 weeks. Like, you know, I'm kind of like Forrest Gump. I'm kind of oblivious to most things, but that there was something there. You know,
chocolate. You're very good with chocolate.
Chocolate. It was a.
One of the things you said to me was that, and this was part of this learning process you were going through. You said, "I was patient. I waited, I watched," and then you talked about the importance of humility, sort of not setting oneself up above or in a sense of stratification, that we're all kind of in the same boat. And this Luca Pacioli's statement, all wealth comes from God, seems to be part of that kind of universalist way of looking at things, like we're all in the same relative to the situation. But you also involved in yourself in some concrete things, like in Pembina. You worked with Pembina for a while. You were actively participating in the setting up of the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy. How were these actions you were taking fitting with these insights, these feelings, these sentiments that you had deep inside you? Was it sort of starting to blend and form sort of ideas?
I think how I was touched in Jerusalem is I would go to the Holy Sepulchre every night, because Frida said, go there and pray. And I would play the pipe organ for the nuns at the Ecce Homo, where they flogged him. Like, was that was the Herodian castle. So you could picture this. My room's looking over the Dome of the Rock, you know, from anyways. And I'm teaching the priests there how to enjoy rusty nail cocktails. And we watch the sunset over Jerusalem and talk about, you know, life.
It sounds like everything was flowing quite freely.
It was spectacular. And I met the most beautiful. Literally, it was the answer to my deepest yearning. And then when I heard this voice, says, why do you think I threw out the money changers? Who do you think crucified me? I'm like, oh, had the most to lose. So I want you to be a co-creator of the civilization of love. I said, what? What kind of commission?
Me?
Civilization? Love? And that's when I started to understand that love is everything. Love is our essence. The gospel of love. Mm. There's only two lines I can live by. Love God, love your neighbor.
Mm. Well, that's what Jesus actually said. Forget all the other stuff. You know, this is where
So then my living and walking prayer is, Lord, show me everything. Show me what I can handle. And show me that, I always say this tongue in cheek, show me the chess moves of your enemy. The enemy of love. Who's the enemy of love? Right? And then you can get it. It's like, okay, now I'm going really.
The enemy, isn't the enemy of love indifference? I mean, people think love, hate, but really it's indifference.
Yeah,
a lack of concern.
You know, we just went through Easter, and what did he say at the end? It is finished. It's all completed. What is there then to do? Oh, to awaken my brothers and sisters from the spell, the trauma of economics, the money systems, our anxiety about tomorrow. Free us from all that anxiety. Create a system of banking and economics that celebrates my joyous creation of you.
So let's move from the beatific principle to compare and contrast GDP and GPI. That's wow, your assignment. That's your assignment, Professor Inyoski.
Going back into the muck again. So,
sorry, I apologize.
I was on a platform with my English friends this morning and a Russian woman too, Marina, this morning at 7 a.m. talking about this. Hmm. I said, and my title slide was the gross domestic error, and or whatever you want to call it, and the genuine progress indicator. And so I often, because I love history, I'm like, what, you know, GDP hasn't been around very long. It was invented in
World War II
to track the cash flow in the British economy.
Yeah.
To tax them for the war effort. So it's fine tracking cash flow, but it's
during
not
a world
as
war.
Bobby Kennedy said, it's not measuring the things that make life worthwhile. And then in 1994-5, I was sitting in my treasury Dilbert cubicle, and this report came in, and it said the U.S. genuine progress indicator. So that's pretty cheeky. You said we're genuine. And so one of some of my peers started saying, you can't do this. Who are you to say genuine? What are the genuine indicators of progress? Well, I said, well, it relates to the word value, doesn't it? Because in the word value in Latin mean to be worthy or strong. That's what it means, Mr. Carney, your book. I don't know if you said that. But, you know, and I thought, this is what I'm going to work on for the rest of my life. I'm going to try to design a different accounting system. I actually literally proposed this to Mr. Soros at Davos in 2011 at the World Economic Forum, not in person, but he says arrogantly, I don't think the world is yet ready for holistic wealth accounting. Says who, George? You? Anyways, so it's, why do I like it? Because it goes back to my accounting roots. It is measuring the conditions of well-being, which is what the word wealth is, aligned hopefully with what we value most, whether you live in Salmon Arm or Edmonton or wherever, Beijing. And it's going to be respected by people because they'll say, I could see myself in those indicators. So if we're only chasing GDP, then it's a flawed accounting system. It's like an adding machine that never stops adding. And by the way, it doesn't have the balance sheet that Luca developed. There's no balance sheet. The GDP is a flow. It's the income statement.
It's unidirectional. It doesn't circular.
Unidirectional.
Yes.
So I said, let me rethink this whole accounting system. So assets now, or anything like a chair that I'm sitting in or a computer, or it could be a relationship. And every asset has a characteristic in accounting language. We say every asset has a utility function, as it provides a flow of, say, well-being benefits. Every asset also could be damaged or encumbered. It can get cancer, right?
Sure.
So let's put all of this together. And people say, oh my God, it's like eating an elephant for an appetizer. And then, Desmond Tutu came to Edmonton. He said, how do you eat an elephant? And he said, one bite at a time, right? So
very good.
So this is my vision. So like big accounting, my accounting stuff comes back like a bad traumatic dream. I go back to Aquinas maybe, or maybe not. Thank God for the AI. I can summarize it very quickly for me now. I'm like, okay, a new accounting system that would be pleasing to Luca. If Luca was alive, he'd be like, I like this guy. And Leonardo, I don't know what he's doing.
I'll draw his picture.
He's still drawing.
And it'll be famous. Not you, but the picture will be famous.
So this is what I've been sort of musing about for 30 odd years now.
So your colleagues got upset about the word genuine, and maybe they even got upset about progress. They probably didn't get upset about indicator because it's kind of a neutral term. But the genuine part, the idea that you as an economist or anyone devising an economic system could not say, this is important, it's genuine, and it's important.
Right.
That seemed to be a sticking point, you said. That the idea to be so, you have the temerity to say, this is really true. You know, if somebody throws a brick at your head and hits you or misses you but almost hits you, that's not demonstrably unpleasant. It's just a brick flying through the air that somehow
it's
neutral.
Yeah, you know, I like that to a physician who only checks the patient's blood pressure and never asks, how's your marriage going, Mark? How are your kids? That would be a good GP, right?
Yes.
Okay, let's diagnose.
That would
patient.
Be an old-fashioned GP.
My old GP, right? Yeah. He'd spend the first 10 minutes asking me about my life as he's checking my reflexes and doing everything else, right? But that's why I thought, wait a minute, I'm just like a doctor. And economists who say, oh, Mark, GDP is so simple. It's just like one indicator. It's like, no, that's just like measuring blood pressure. It's not the whole thing. Like, it's a complex system.
So you actually trundled off to California. You actually went to...
They were going to hire me, redefining progress, which was a dream job. Like, I'm like, oh, my... I told my wife, this is like, I can't believe they're going to hire me to do the GPI work in... Mm. One of the best think tanks probably in the world, according to, you know, because I was like so passionate about it. Mm. And then I did the math and my wife said, we can't afford to live here. And it was true. We could, they could afford me to pay me enough money or the health, you know, health benefit equivalent. So I said, no, we said no. And stayed in Edmonton.
You were the mouthpiece, but she was the voice.
Yeah. Anyways, they hired me anyways later. Mm. The woman they hired couldn't do it because she was a journalist. And I'm like, would you do it, Mark? Would you update it? And I'm like, sure. And then my vision was, that was really hard. That was really hard work. Then I had a vision. I wanted to set up a center like Redefining Progress in Canada at the University of Alberta, a multidisciplinary well-being economic center. And my dean of business said, good luck with that.
Which is another way of saying it can never be done.
Because we're not transdisciplinary.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Back off. Anyways, I did the work anyways. Mm-hmm. I did it with the Pemina Institute because they said, come over here. Come work with us.
Isn't it true that as an idea changes in your mind, if you're not saying it's got to always happen this way, you say, well, maybe it can't happen that way, but it could happen this other way. And this movement between government and nonprofit and social value versus, you know, monetary value, it seems to me that's a certain fluidity that really does work well for you. I mean, it's works well for anybody, but you seem to have an adept process going on.
I mean, it wasn't easy. Like, I had a cushy, you know, I was 13 years in government.
You had a pension.
I still got my pension. It's not that much, but I had the comfort, right? Security. But I realized, oh my God, if I spend another year here, then I'm going to stay for 30, right? just to get the number. And so as my wife reminds me, it wasn't easy. There was a lot of anxiety about being a consultant, being an ex-bureaucrat.
Speaking of your wife, why don't you just give a little of her background? Because she's her values, if you like, align very clearly with your own. And that was obviously an important point. How did she enter your life in the usual dipsy-doodle way?
That connects to Jerusalem. So we would go out before I went. I said, I'm leaving for 3 months. And she said, whatever. Like, we would just have these raging discussions about God. And she said, I can't believe I'm kind of dating this charismatic Catholic guy and I'm a lapsed Anglican and whatever. Anyways, so I said, I'm going to go, I got to do this. I got to find out what God wants. And then it was in Jerusalem that Frida said, you're not going to be a priest. You're going to be, I'm like, oh, so I
anything but a priest.
I'm like, Jen, I'll be home in a week. I got to start dating. What are you talking about? So anyways, 6 months later, we were engaged. And a year after I got back from Jerusalem, we were married. So it's like, wait a minute. So you want me to marry this woman? I'm getting called back to economics and I'm going to marry this woman. And, you know, if you're a charismatic, especially a charismatic Catholic at the time, like, there's no way this is going to work. and then I meet her at a bar because she's working at a bar close to where I work.
An economist walked into a bar
and said, hey, anyways, I was cheeky the way I got introduced to her. And I thought, I like her attitude. She's very, you know, she's got caustic attitude. Turns out she's like the granddaughter, the great-granddaughter of the founding of the Canadian Bar Association. So she's serving guys from Justice, and she gets a good job. So we get married. She gets a job at the Court of Queen's Bench. And she starts getting interested in restorative justice.
And not a bad thing.
Victim offender mediation. And she has, over her whole marriage, 33 years, become probably Canada's leading expert on restorative justice, working with victims of violent crime, murder cases.
So I can just imagine so you this can imagine supper conversation.
Yeah. So that's the kind of wonderful dance. And we both, you know, we tell the girls, you know, it's your parents. We work from home the entire time.
Hmm.
And so it's been a beautiful life. Successful in mysterious ways I would have never anticipated.
And a life where, speaking of values, which is I introduced our conversation with about the notion of values, that values, if they're shared, deeply felt values are shared. I mean, it's sort of a bond that, especially if you can make jokes from time to time about the
you
whole
have
situation.
To have a sense of humor. Like, God has a sense of humor. Come
absolutely.
On.
Exactly. Like,
oh, I always say you have to laugh because life is like, I always think we're way too serious about life. Like, come on. Like, it's supernatural.
Yeah. Good. It's a good way to look at it. Well, many cultures don't eliminate non-material influences. They accept that they are real and they don't always come in a packaged, you know, like in the mail with a label and a return address on. They just appear. Like you were, the people you met when you were in Jerusalem. But you've met a lot of people and interacted with a lot of people, and that does seem to be a strong theme. And you mentioned Herman Daly. Why don't you talk a little bit about him? Because he is a fairly solidly entrenched, towering figure within ecological economics, if you want to call it a syllable, polysyllabic introduction. What role did he play and how did you connect with him?
Both he and John Cobb, who actually became my true mentor, John Cobb Jr., the Whiteheadian theologian at Claremont. So some of you know that they both co-authored For the Common Good, 1986, I believe. And I picked that up and I thought, wow, this is the Bible. And you know, Herman Daly, so when I went on the Jerusalem trip, my first stop was Stockholm. I went to the second annual meeting of the Ecological Economics Society, mm-hmm. and eventually became president of the Canadian Society. And Herman Daly was there. And there was a yelling match going on in the university auditorium there between, you know, Ehrlich, I think, you know, you had the ecologist and economist, you know, accusing each other of whatever, ecocide and whatever. And I thought, this is fascinating. I love this tension between ecology and economics. It's beautiful because, of course, I'm a forester and I'm presenting my paper called In Search of the Carbonic Truth, which is a really tongue-in-cheek.
Indeed.
I was cheating because I knew that if I presented this paper at an international conference, it's going to get published, but I would never be allowed to as a bureaucrat.
No, you'd have to do it anonymously.
So I met Herman, indirectly Bob Costanza. So in a very small group, right? So now I'm a bona fide ecological economist. I get hired to do the genuine progress indicator work. And after I turned down the job, they hired me to do it. And I insisted on going to see Herman in Washington, and I went to the World Bank and I met with people there. I insisted on meeting John Cobb and Cliff Cobb, his son. So in For the Common Good, the first GPI emerges called the Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare, which they drafted in that book. And it was John Cobb's son, Cliff, who developed the analytics.
Hmm.
So part of my little project is I'm going to San Francisco, I'm going to meet these amazing people. Then I asked John Cobb, I said, in your second edition For the Common Good, you have a chapter on money in the appendix, and you talk about the great chemist Frederick Soddy. Why did it take you so long to talk about money and relationship sustainability? And he said, John was amazing. He just passed away at 100 years of age last year. Amazing human being and just a beautiful mentor to me. To say, I had to convince Herman we had to look at the money system. And I realize most economists have no idea where money comes from. We talk about it. And supply curves, right? Price to quantity. Nobody actually knows where the money originates.
A small detail.
I'm like, what, Herman? So I said, when I went to see Herman in his office in Washington, and I have this joke. He says, you know, I was stunned. I was like, because I'd seen him in Stockholm, but I didn't realize when I sat right across his desk, he was this little office because he was also isolated. Like they wouldn't let him in the economics. The World Bank kicked him out because he challenged the growth, right? I almost started laughing. I noticed he only had one arm.
Really?
My goodness. Like, you know, and there's that joke about the economics, like economists are always like torn on one hand and on the other hand. And I said, wait a minute, Herman's always right. He only has one hand.
There's no other hand. Oh my goodness. So, what an interesting reality.
Yes. So the turning point then was I'm sitting there in his office. This is 1999. And I've got this book called The Grip of Death by Michael Robotham. Robotham was an English guy who studied C.H. Douglas' social credit ideas. And sure. I read his book. He came and stayed with us in Edmonton. And I'm like, and I saw Herman's endorsement of his book. And I said, Herman, like, why did you endorse Michael Robotham's book, The Grip of Death? The word mortgage means a death pledge. So he's talking about we're all mortgaged, right? And Herman says to me, Mark, the relationship between debt and GDP is perhaps the most unexamined issue in economics. And I would highly encourage you to make this your singular focus.
You're being in another injunction to do this right now.
So I'm like, yes, Herman, I'm going to do it.
So what did you do with that? How did you actually put that in?
Then I went home and I went, function. I'm going to, because I'm a stats guy. So I'm like, well, didn't really do that well in stats. But anyways, I thought, let's look at the relationship between GDP and total debt, because all money is debt. That's important to make a fine point on that. All money is debt. And 90% of money, Mr. Carney admitted that when he was Bank of England governor, is created when private banks issue loans. I'm like, so what number do I look for in the Federal Reserve data? There's table D3, the total outstanding debt in the United States. I run the numbers. I go back to 1945, contrast with GDP, and guess what? There's a R squared of 0.98.
Which you have to explain to listeners what an R squared is.
There's an absolute perfect correlation. Yes. As debt is growing exponentially, GDP has to grow. And I don't know if you know the name David Corton. He wrote the book.
Oh, yes. Yeah, When Corporations Rule the World.
So he comes to Edmonton. He does a guest lecture to the U of A through the Parkland Institute. And I put up my hand. I said, and I'm working on the GPI at this point. And he says, I think there's these graphs that are important to the world. And he has these just line graphs on the slide. I put up my hand and said, hi, David. I'm Mark Nielski. I'm actually working on the GPI right now. He goes, oh, wow. And, you know, he knew about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's this recovering Harvard business professor who, you know. And I said, I'm also working on that one of your line graphs there on the relationship with debt and GDP, because Herman Bailey inspired me to. He goes, you are? Anyways, this is an election. And then I went after, we had a little, after the lecture, I went up to him and said, I didn't mean to embarrass you or out you, but he said, are you actually working on this? I said, yeah, I've crunched the numbers. Do you want to see them? He goes, please, email. He goes back to, you know, Bainbridge Island and he's flipping out. He goes, Mark, I'm coming to Edmonton. We're writing a book together. You and I, we're going to write Making Money, Growing Poor. And he comes to Edmonton for a week. And we scope out this book. Because he said, that graph that you just produced is the most important graph I've ever seen. And again, I honored Herman by continuing then to say, well, Okay, so what we're seeing is, why do you think there's pressure to attack Iran? Why do you think all these things are happening? And there, it's a runaway train. It's like, how are we going to put the genie back? I don't know. These are, you know, the issues of the day, and hardly anyone understands what's actually driving everything. In my view, like, everything relates to where the money pressure is pushing us into conflict, into ecological destruction. And it's all a human-created system.
Yes. I think there's a growing awareness of that, even though people don't know the nuts and bolts and maybe some of the terminology, but they can certainly see that people are attached to, humans are attached to our interpretation of what Mother Nature is, rather than what Mother Nature actually is. And it's like the GPI versus GDP. GDP, just linear addition. And GPI said, well, what's the meaning or the value of each of these parameters? I just want to clarify, or have maybe you clarify it, so that listeners understand why the GPI is a revolution towards sanity, not a diversion from a tried and true system that still works, because it doesn't work. The GDP is a kind of a failing system by and large.
Yeah, well, the GPI again is, I'll put it very simply, like when I was interviewed by Redefining Progress, I said, it's fine to have, the first GPI was just a monetary adjustment to GDP, saying, we've got environmental pollution, that's a negative. We've got, you know, we weren't even counting things like cancer and that, or chronic illness, as a negative, because, right? Do you want more cancer or less cancer? Do you want more suicide or less? Do you want more divorce or less? Like, some of these, right, value issues are common sense. Some are less. Some people are like, divorce is fine for me. It's like, that's where we got into some complexities, where people are like, well, some things you're, you know, crime rate, okay, we can agree. But when we do a full cost accounting on some of those economic attributes of the economy that we would say are regrettable or negative to our well-being, clearly we can monetize those and adjust the GDP accordingly. Now, that's problematic for politicians who like upward sloping, right? We want growth to keep going. We can't have a flat curve, a straight curve like we showed in the U.S., or downward sloping curve, which started after the OPEC oil crisis in 1973. Like, we have a downward GPI curve, and upward sloping, of course, GDP curve. So problematic for, Prime Minister Chrétien, whoever the prime, you know, like, they're not going to like that.
They'd have to read books.
They have to read books. And then when we released our Alberta GPI work, because that was my vision, right? I'm going to do it for Alberta because I know Alberta's data. We're going to go back to 1960 when I was born and look in the rearview mirror. Mm. And I got the best compliment Ralph Klein ever gave me, which was no comment. When the CBC National asked them, like, what's your opinion of Anielski and Pemba's work? And he said, no comment. They're entitled to their own opinion. And the problem then was I was working for them. Before that, I was working for Jim Denning.
The idea that some perceptions are dicey, they somehow don't have a basis in reality and others don't. This inability sometimes to use concrete evidence, actual stories, if you like, or narratives, or even just historical. You said you're always liked history, and of course history, they say, you learn its lessons or you're going to repeat them, you know, especially the mistakes.
That's right. So my inquiry then became, is there such a thing as if there's determinants of health, and you know this is a physician, right? The determinants of health model. Are there determinants of well-being, even if we quibble about what we value, say, of Albertans? Because Ralph Klein used to say, oh, quality of life, you know, I said, what, you go to Calgary, you ask people, why do you love living in Calgary? Why do you stay here? And they'll tell you all kinds of things. They'll say, oh, I got great neighbors and whatever, you know, I love the mountains, or, okay, check. These are all attributes of well-being, what we value. Like, you wouldn't live in Vancouver if you didn't like certain things, right? So let's discover what people actually value, and then let's measure those well-being conditions aligned, because when we report the indicators, citizen and go, those are meaningful indicators. Mm-hmm. I don't understand GDP, but I understand whether I trust my neighbor or, you know, I feel safe walking alone at night. And then people say, oh, it's so complex. Mark, you've made it more complex because every city will have its own value set. I was like, that's okay. That's like an ecosystem. They're all diverse and unique. Yeah. What's wrong with the complexity?
Yes.
You can't handle complexity. Oh, you want a nice, clean indicator like GDP. I was like, fine, keep your GDP. But I'm happy to swim in complexity because I'm the well-being physician. Like, I'm doing a full diagnostic.
Yes.
And I can't say which, I can't even tell you which indicators weighted one way or another.
Now, just diverting a little bit for a moment, one of the thoughtful people that you registered in your analysis or analyses was Plato. And Plato's been dead for a long time, but he had some things to say a long time ago that are resonating very, very much with what we're talking about now. And one of the things he said was virtue. Virtue as defined a certain personal characteristics was essential for happiness. And he named it, the four cardinal virtues were courage, justice, moderation, and prudence or wisdom.
That's right.
Why don't you expand on that? Because people listening to us talk sometimes would say, well, you know, making money is completely separate. You know, you just do what you have to do. Kind of like the Catholic goes to do confession on Sunday and says, okay, we've solved that problem. Now let's go back to whatever behavior we have.
I wish all politicians examined their conscience like Ben Franklin did every night.
Yes, indeed. Who said?
No, but even Jefferson said, without virtue, happiness cannot be. So whether you're quoting Plato. And what is virtue? Virtua, like a characteristic of goodness. Mm-hmm. Yes. Qualities that are you know, worth our respect, qualities of behavior. So like, okay, it's complicated. My wife would say, you can't get into that. You can't say these are the virtues we should uphold as Edmonton City Council. I'm like, no, I'm not saying that. But if you examine, as Ben, I would teach my business to you, what did Ben Franklin do every night? He examined 14 social and personal virtues. Hmm. Examination of conscience.
Yes, which is remarkably like what mindfulness is all about. You know, mindfulness being that you don't do things unconsciously. You try your best to have an idea of why you're doing what you're doing. And if you're not sure, then you try to learn more about yourself or about the world, or you meditate or whatever. I want to talk about something that has become part of your life very much in these days, and that is connecting to indigenous views. By indigenous, I mean indigenous people who have lived on the land for a very long time and are deeply embedded in what we talked about earlier, natural law, and how important that's become in your day-to-day life these days.
Yeah, it's they've changed my life. My first encounter was going to Nunavut when the Inuit asked me to develop their state of well-being, a culture report. They had just become a new, jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. It was 2000. It was just, what was it, 2005? I can't even remember. Three, I think, lost count of time. But they said, we love what you did with the GPI. Could you come up here? And that changed my life. I went up to Nunavut and I realized, oh, these people are still untouched by colonial. Like, there's a sense of their connection to the land.
So you were meeting indigenous communities which were still intact and still had active participation in a value system that was unique.
Interestingly enough, Nunavut established both a circular government, so a similar part, you know, but they would sit in circle. It was another piece we could talk about for a long time. Why do we sit in rows, like the British? Like, no, in Nunavut, they sit in a circle, right?
Like the British factories.
I know, like Preston Manning once, I asked him once, like, why are the Destin Parliament exactly that far apart? He goes, they're exactly two broadsword lengths apart.
Yes, that's right. That's right. What?
Anyways, I digress.
Yes.
But Nunavut set up another entity called the Nunavut Tungavut Corporation. They're the ones who had a mandate to have this annual state of culture report. They're the ones who hired me. So I go up there and I meet these young Inuit policy people. And I'm like, can we go meet the elders? Oh, we haven't seen the elders we have to prepare. I said, because I want to ask them, what are your values? Because if I'm going to develop indicators, they're not going to be the stuff that Ottawa sees. they're going to honor your teachings. And what are their teachings? To survive, to flourish on the landscape, right. Build an igloo, kill a polar bear. You know, all of these skills and competencies. I'm like, oh, that changed my life. I'm like, so we went to see the elders. We prepared. We brought them our muktuk and char. And like, and they, the young people said, oh, there's protocol. You never ask a question until the elders have spoken. and only then maybe you can ask them one question. And I said, I've learned something about the medicine wheel. What does teenage suicide mean on the medicine wheel teachings? The old Inuit man said, it means that spiritual side of them is broken, is imbalanced. Mm-hmm. And that led me to then study the medicine wheel and study, oh, medicine wheel teachings were given to Maslow, Abraham Maslow, when he came to Alberta, sat with the Blackfoot, mm-hmm. and turned it into a pyramid, just like every other British person, seems like. You know,
he loves pyramids.
Here's my medicine. Like, here it is.
It's round. It's round.
It's
round.
It's a circle, Maslow. Anyways. So what I've learned from working with them, and I work with First Nations across Canada, is with great respect of their teachings. There's seven sacred laws that start with humility and with love, again, in the circle. The medicine wheel teachings, I use that to assess their well-being using well-being surveys, try to incorporate the well-being data into their governance, business planning, et cetera, even banking now and finance. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to encourage them to think about how to establish their own banks, investment trusts that are all oriented towards their well-being, like a well-being bank.
Yes, for sure.
So that's what I'm working on. I'm having a time in my life. I'm working with the Cree Nation, Quebec, which is a third of the province. I've done all of Manitoba. I've done Comox First Nation. I've done all of Alberta Treaties 6, 7, and 8. I've worked with the Dene in the north. They love me. They keep inviting me back.
And now we have a term, indigenomics. In other words, indigenous economics from an indigenous perspective. And you were actually chief economist for the Indigenomics Institute with Carol Ann Hilton, who is a real powerhouse in the world of bringing economic ideas to the natural law perspective. And I quoted something here. It says, and this is from the sort of rules by which the Indigenomics Institute functions. And the quote is this: as the world converges on an economic identity crisis of its own making, the inclusion and revaluing of Indigenous worldview and knowledge in economy and business is paramount. Now, I think a lot of people are starting to think that way. In health circles, for example, people are starting to think, well, we're one with the ecosystem, we're not separate, and ecological economists say the human economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the natural economy.
Yeah,
so these ideas, these are really starting to take root, it seems to me, seriously take root.
Carol Ann's amazing. Like Carol Ann Hilton, she's from the Whale People, a new channel nation.
Yes.
North of Tofino. She's a brilliant woman. She's actually the one who got me re-inspired or re-confident, I guess, in First Nations, because I was getting very frustrated with the way they were just poor business people. They were disrespectful, some of them that I was dealing with.
Yeah.
But she said, I'm going to launch Indigenomics, and why don't we have fun? And I said, as long as we're having fun, you bring the contracts. Well, I can crunch numbers this way and that way and help. So it's been a lot of fun. I do small stuff with them now, but she's absolutely right. And I think a worldview, like I always say, like what I've learned about Indigenous people or Indian, some call them still Red Indian, is the teachings of, I know you could say like, anyways, is that there's a beautiful belief in my heart that Ganata means sacred place, right? It also means village. So Ganata still has this, we still have so much to learn from their worldview, from their connection to the nature, their way of their laws, their traditional teachings, that I think can re-inspire Turtle Island itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
and including the United States, which has lost sight of the great law of peace, which was given to the Haudenosaunee in Syracuse, way before, you know, even George Washington respected.
Yes.
You know, and so these are the stories, like, I never hear Americans talking about the great law of peace or, you know, these teachings of the water, sacred, you know, how the women carry the laws of water in their, you know, all these things that I've come to learn. And again, it's not my culture, but I appreciate the spectacular worldview that they bring. And I think we're going to be better off for it.
You know, I'm looking at the time, and we're getting near the end of our time, and obviously we're not near the end of our conversation, so so we're going to have to artificially impose an end on this.
Yeah,
but
that's
but I want to read listeners to hear what you wrote when I had a copy of your book called The Economics of Happiness, and you autographed it, and you probably don't remember what you wrote, but you'll
no,
remember.
I never remember.
I hope you don't remember what you wrote, because that would be very strange. You said, to Warren May, you rediscover the audacious 8-year-old hidden in the chamber of your genuine heart, which is
wow.
Well, that's what I said at the time, and I said it when I looked at it again. So my genuine heart is still ticking, and although I do have a pacemaker now, which helps it along, but I think we'll probably have some more conversations, Mark, because this is the stuff that I think we all should be thinking about. You know, bringing things together and establishing relationships and making the world a little more circular in the way we think about it. I think that's all pretty much germane to the human journey.
Actually, to put a fine, because I never stop talking, is one thing I've learned about from First Nations people is A, they learn with stories, they sit in circle. And I say all the answers to our questions can be found in the circle when we don't interrupt each other. And I asked Preston Manning that. Can we sit in the legislatures, passing the eagle feather or a kitchen spoon, and not interrupt each other and have conversations of importance in which we can all celebrate the collective wisdom? And you know what he said? He says, yes, Mark, I think that's a good idea, but I don't think the existing members of legislature are willing to do what you're suggesting. But we can show them how, you know, Preston's kind of voice.
Well, the opportunity will be passed on to you now, because Preston Manning has decided to vacate the field. Look,
yes,
Mark, it's wonderful talking with you, and we'll do that again in the future. And there are many things that that ramify from what we've talked about here into lots of different areas. Thank you very much for being with us today, and look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.